We find that kashrut is one of the three major pillars of Jewish religious life. Kashrut, Shabbat, and marital purity, laws of marriage. And yet, many people don't even think about the moral foundations of kashrut. Why? Why keep kosher? And one of the things we have to do in order to maintain the loyalty of our youth, the young people, is to introduce people to the ideas of the laws. Not just keeping the law, but why? What's the idea behind it? We must show people that it's not just a ceremony or ritual to be discarded at will, but the commandments have reasons in order for us to keep them. They're not just dry things which we do. Everything has a reason which we have to for keeping them. They're religious power stations for the creation of holiness among the people of Israel. So what we're trying to do is these commandments are trying to reinforce and create and vitalize spirituality amongst our people. And that's one of the problems we're facing today is no one's explaining these ideas. How do we explain these ideas to our children? So this is the topic basically tonight is why keep kosher? Why do we have to keep kosher? What are the reasons behind keeping kosher? We find Maimonides tells us that even though that we have to keep God's law anyway, nevertheless, since God gave us brains, we have to try and think, why did God give us this law? God didn't just come along and make up the laws for no reason. Obviously, there are reasons for the laws. So let us try tonight, go through a few reasons for kashrut, and you'll find there are many different reasons on different levels. Usually there are three different levels in terms of explaining Jewish law. The most basic level is the ethical level. If God gave us the laws of kashrut, it must be to make us better people in some sort of way. There must be a reason in terms of ethics. Why would God give us the law of kashrut if not to make us better? And we'll talk more about that. The second reason is usually a mystical reason. Why would God give us a level of kashrut? Because the Kabbalah and the Zohar, every mitzvah is of cosmic importance. Everything a person does reaches not just in this dimension, but in the dimensions above. There's a source for everything. And everything we do in this world, we are cooperating with God in the drama of history and the guidance of the world. And that's true about any mitzvah, not just about kashrut. The third usual reason for mitzvot is symbolic interpretation. A mitzvah is a symbol of something. God is trying to teach us a lesson utilizing symbolism. And we find this with many mitzvot. We put a mezuzah on the door. It's a symbol that God protects our house. It's a symbol that this house is a house of holiness. So also, laws of kashrut, it must be a symbol of something deeper. So the third, we're going to go through all these different, try and go through them tonight, the different reasons for Jewish law in terms of kashrut. Why keep kosher? I just want to start off with a little story. There's a beautiful story. It says of the rabbi who was on a flight and he asked for kosher food. So he ordered kosher meals. And then when the stewardess comes, she gives him a special meal. They don't want to call it a kosher meal, they call it a special meal. Did you order a special meal? Yes, I ordered a special meal. So she gives him a kosher meal. And he asked the stewardess, he says, please tell me, do you know what makes the meal kosher? So she said, yes. I had a Jewish boyfriend. He explained to me that before they slaughter the chicken, there's a rabbi that comes and blesses the chicken. So that's, unfortunately, that's what most people think in terms of kashrut, is there's a rabbi over there blessing the chickens. So then she asked the rabbi a question. She said, Rabbi, I've always wondered, if the rabbi by mistake would bless a pig, would the pig become kosher? So the rabbi answers, he says, no, he said, but the rabbi would become non-kosher. But that's the unfortunate statement today, is a lot of people don't know even what kashrut is all about. You see a kosher and you think, you know, the rabbi is blessing the animals. So you can envisage, you know, the animals going down the line and the slaughterhouse and the rabbi going and blessing them, each one. It's amazing how people can think of such a thing. But that is the usual idea. People think it's kosher, that means the rabbis, they're blessing the food. So we find there are three major reasons for Jewish law in general. One is ethical, the second is mystical, and the third is symbolism. a lot of symbolism in Jewish law. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, who is the rabbi in Germany, chief rabbi of Frankfurt, is mainly the one who talks about the symbolism of Jewish law. Let's talk a bit about the ethics involved in kashrut. What are the ethics involved in kashrut? The first idea is to limit the number of animals that the Jew is permitted to kill and eat. Second idea is a ban on eating meat with blood in it. Judaism has an aversion to blood. Third idea is to render the slaughter of the permitted animals as painless as possible. And the fourth idea is to instill discipline into a person. You're hungry, you're starving, you can't go anywhere and eat. Have discipline. Control. Control the basic desire of food. The fourth idea, we said, is self-discipline. And the fifth idea is to help sustain Judaism and the cohesion of the Jewish community. A person goes to a certain town and they keep kosher. What are they going to do? They're going to look in the phone book for a kosher restaurant. If there's no kosher restaurant, they're going to look in the phone book for a rabbi. And if there's no rabbi, look for a Jewish community. We need to find kosher food. Please help us. So usually there's an invitation. Please come over. It's a Friday night. Come over for a meal. You don't have any food. We'll come over. We'll provide you a kosher food. What does that do? That helps social unity. The Jews stick together. Why? By force. They're forced to eat a certain kind of diet. And except for America, we can go to any supermarket in the States and you find things with the OU. It's not so convenient anywhere else. It's the only probably country in the world, apart from Israel, where it's convenient to be kosher. It's not really inconvenient. When I was in Canada, it's a totally different story. There's no OU across the border. There's what's known as a COR. It's a Canadian Orthodox Rabbinate. It comes from Toronto. So if you're not living in the East Coast, try and find a COR anywhere. Or you try and find an MK, which is Montreal kosher. Few and far between. You go to a supermarket, you're stuck. You don't know what is kosher, what is not kosher. There's no OUs in Canada. Meat, double the price. Chicken is double the price. Everything is double the price. So we're fortunate we're living in a country where kashrut is everywhere. Not only is kashrut everywhere, it's become a status symbol. There are more non-Jews probably buying kosher than Jews for different dietary reasons. But also they look at this OU as a sign of superiority. It's a sign of someone's inspecting another inspector. Not just the USDA, but also the OU. The rabbis are also inspecting, it can't be bad. And that's why you have OUs today on things which don't really need them. For instance, detergent. You don't need an OU. Detergent doesn't have to be kosher. You don't eat the detergent. Maybe some people lick their clothes, I don't know. But you don't normally eat the detergent, so therefore detergent does not have to be kosher. And yet, you find an OU, you look for detergents, you find there are OUs, there's OKs, there's all sorts of things on the detergent. Why? It became a quality control symbol. Yes. Okay, so we'll talk about that. We'll go into more details in the classes which are coming on in terms of the laws of kashrut. I don't want to go into it so much today. Basically, whatever's not edible by even a dog, no laws of kashrut apply. That's the basic criteria. If a dog would eat your palm olive soap, you better start worrying how kosher it is. The dog is not going to drink the palm olive soap. You don't have to worry about the kashrut of the palm olive soap. It's not edible. It's telling you it's not edible. Kashrut only applies to food, edible food. Things which are not edible, the Bible tells us. It says, if you slaughter the meat wrongly, what do you do with the meat? The Bible tells us, "Lekelev tashlichunato," throw it to the dogs. Which implies that if the dogs won't even eat it, there's no problem with the kashrut. It's interesting. It's an interesting idea, which we'll discuss later on when we talk about the laws of kashrut. The classic example the Talmud gives is chewing a leather belt. How many people chew the leather watch straps? I know my kids in the habit today, they're all plastic anyway. But in those days, they were leather. The closer you get to chewing gum was leather straps. Is a person allowed to chew a leather strap? And the code of Jewish law says yes. Why? Because they're not edible. The taste is gone. They're like wood. Nothing edible over there. I don't want to go into the laws of kashrut. I just want to go to ethics of kashrut. So number one is, it's a ban on eating meat with blood in it. This week's Torah portion as well. Noah, time of Noah, one of the laws given was not to eat the limb from a living animal or the blood. The Bible tells us, and there's a big debate amongst the authorities, what is exactly the law over there? Not just for Jews, but for non-Jews as well. So most authorities, the Rambam included, say it's just a law of not pulling a limb from a living animal and eating the limb. But it's interesting, there's dietary laws, not just for Jews, also for non-Jews. Not just that, the first law given to Adam, what was the law given to Adam? Don't eat from the fruit of the tree of knowledge, whatever it was. But it's interesting, it was a dietary law. I'm going to talk about that more next week. But the dietary laws are there. Why? Because the propensity of man, the first instinct of a person is food. That's number one. Child is born, why? Child is hungry. Food is very, very important. The earliest of Judaism's dietary laws is the ban on eating blood. The Bible tells us because the blood is the soul of the animal. The soul is in the blood. In other words, without the blood, the animal would die. And therefore, it's a life force, and therefore, eating blood is prohibited from the Torah. Man has a right to nourishment, but not a right to life. So life is in the blood, and therefore, it's called the lifeblood. And therefore, we're not allowed to eat blood. The unique practice of draining blood from meat has over thousands of years a profoundly moral impact. It has helped to produce an antipathy to bloodthirst. If you look through all the pagan cultures, and then you look at Jewish culture, look at the Romans, look at the Greeks, look at the gladiators, and look at the amphitheaters they built in order to watch blood sports. Till today, boxing. Violent sports are really the descendants of these previously more bloody sports. Rooster fighting, dog fighting, all these kind of things are bloody sports, which Judaism had a tremendous aversion to. We can't eat blood. We don't want to see blood. We're not interested in blood. Blood does not interest us. So therefore, there's already over there, there's an ethical idea over there, is an aversion to blood. We find one of the French psychologists says, you know what? He says, when he grew up in France before the Second World War, if the mother wanted to eat chicken that night, what would they do? There was no frozen chicken in the market. What would they do? Each house grew chickens. What happened? The mother took the chicken in the kitchen in front of all the kids, wrung the chicken's neck and killed the chicken in front of everyone. So that caused people not to have an aversion to blood sports. In other words, they see death right in front of them. You kill a kid chicken. My own mother killed the chicken in front of her eyes. My mother's cruel. She killed the chicken in front of us. So if she can do it, I can do it. The Jewish law says no. A woman cannot come along and kill the chicken herself. Today, we take it for granted. You go and buy, whether you keep kosher or not go kosher, you buy things which are already killed over there. But in Jewish law, it's interesting. 50 years ago, this wasn't the case. You had your own chickens in your backyard. Who would kill them? Mother can't kill them. She takes them to the shochet. Who is the shochet? The shochet is basically a rabbi. The rabbi is meant to be the most ethical person. Who's allowed to kill? We don't allow anyone to kill. Because killing, once a person starts killing, they lose their ethics and they lose their aversion to bloodshed. Just kill, 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 kill. That was a test the Nazis had for their stormtroopers. Raise the dog and then kill your own pet dog. If you can kill your own pet dog, you can kill any human. That's the first step. Get person used to killing. Kill animals and then kill human beings later on. That's the next step. Jewish law says, you know, no one's allowed to kill except for people who are very, very ethical. Hopefully the shochet is meant to be very ethical. You see the movies produced by Empire Poultry. They have this beautiful movie and they show you the people who are the shochatim, their slaughterers, are big rabbis and they learn every morning. They pray three times a day and they do this and they do that. That's what makes the meat kosher. So it's the ethics involved in not eating blood produce the aversion to bloodshed. The ban on eating a limb from a living animal, which is the Torah law, we said, for humanity. This had been a very common practice before refrigeration. If I kill the whole animal, what's going to happen? It's going to go bad. All the meat's going to get spoiled. I can't eat all that meat. What am I going to do? Amputate the leg. Amputate another leg. Keep on going till when I need to finish the meat. So Judaism comes along. No, it's not allowed. It's a universal law. It's a law of cruelty to animals. It's barbaric. Who said that? First law written in the book of Noah. If you look at the book of Noah tomorrow, this week's parasha we're coming to, the Bible tells us don't eat the limb from a living animal. We take it for granted today, but it's common. You see children, unfortunately, they cruelly torturing little animals and insects and things like that. Judaism says no, we're not allowed to do that. The next expression of Judaism's application of morality to eating animals constitutes the essential moral meaning of kashrut. Keeping kosher, we're going to talk about, is Judaism's compromise with its ideal of being a vegetarian, eating vegetables. Where do we see this? We see this that Adam, we're going to talk about it this week as well at the parasha, Adam was only allowed to eat from the fruit of trees. He was not allowed to eat animals. Adam, at the beginning of the Bible, the Torah tells us, God tells him, he says, I've given to you all the fruits of the trees and of the ground for food. That's it. No animals. Noah comes out the ark, and God tells Noah, you can have the trees and the fruit on the ground, and also you can have animals as well. So we see the ideal in the Garden of Eden, which is the sort of paradise, idyllic sort of existence. What was the most ideal existence? Most ideal existence was vegetables, fruits, that's it. Kashrut really is a bit of a compromise with this idea. We find later on, by the book of Isaiah, chapter 11 tells us that even the animals eventually will become vegetarian. The lions will eat hay. I'd like to see lions eat hay. But that's Isaiah's prophecy for the future, is the ideal society would be a vegetarian society. And that's the prediction of Rabbi Cook, who was one of the first chief rabbis of Israel. Also, he was a big vegetarian. So, even though Judaism does not legislate this, what does Judaism say about eating meat? Jewish law says, book of Deuteronomy, you open up chapter 12, you'll find, it says, if you desire meat, you may eat it. Because if you have a craving for it, we're not going to legislate against this craving for meat. And we can ask the question, why? And that is, number one, is it's not the ideal. Only if you have a special desire for it, you're allowed to eat it. And the Talmud says over there that a person should not make this the daily meal. It's only for special occasions. The Talmud says on the festivals, you should have meat 3 times a year. But apart from that, there's no mitzvah to eat meat. It's not a mitzvah to go to Dan's and buy meat. Just in order to help him survive, there's no mitzvah. It's only when a person has a craving for meat. It's going to be a craving, then a person can eat meat. Why? Obviously, the Torah thought that, you know, I want to limit it, but I don't want to go to the extreme because there's an innate desire of man to have some meat. I want the Jews to feel good. So sometimes, 3 times a year, whatever, we can feel good. Have some meat. The Jewish ideal, however, is we not kill for food. It's a compromise known as kashrut. Places a strict limit on the number of animal species which we may kill. We'll talk about that as well. What are the other ideas? What are the two signs for a kosher animal? What are the two signs for a kosher animal? Has a cloven hooves and chews the cud. Remember, by chewing the cud, it means it goes in and it chews and it goes into the stomach and comes out again and chews again. So it ruminates. These animals have many stomachs. The cow, I think, has 7 stomachs. Goes in one, comes out, goes in the other, comes out. It's a continually digestion. It probably has indigestion all the time. It's a cow, that's why it makes the noises. You know, moo, it's total indigestion. You know. By the way, it's very complicated. Why do we get milk from cows? Why can't they make it artificially? So the answer is it's too expensive. The cow can transform grass into milk cheaper than any human factory can. It's interesting. It's a factory for making milk. It's amazing what a cow can do. So it's got to have split hooves, and it has to chew its cud. What is that in terms of ethics? What does that mean? What does that do for us? Fish. The two signs for a fish as well. What are the two signs for a fish? Fins and scales. So what? What does that do for us? And then, birds. Any signs for birds? Birds of prey are not allowed. In fact, the Bible lists, there's a whole list, I think it's 18 birds mentioned, which are not kosher. Today, we say we don't know what those meaning of those Hebrew words are. We've lost the meaning of those 18 words. And therefore, we don't eat any birds for which there is no custom. So today, there's a custom, I think, of six varieties of birds. We'll talk about it later on. Only 6 birds are kosher today. If you go to a kosher store, you don't find 6 varieties of birds. But the others are not kosher. Why? Because there's no custom. Really, vast majority of birds are kosher. But today, we don't have a custom, and therefore, we don't know, since we don't know those words, the meaning of those words in the Bible, we don't eat any birds where there's no custom. But why these particular characteristics? So you can answer, you can say, why is a red light shown as a stop sign and a green light shown as a go sign? Why? Why did they pick those kind of lights? So red stands for warning for a certain reason and green stands for go. Why? Okay, it could be arbitrary. In a different society, they may choose the other opposite. So we could say that this is arbitrary. God just wants to limit the amount of animals we eat. But we do find there's something deeper going through them, and that is all the animals we're allowed to eat are not animals of prey. They're always slow, and they're always domesticated, and they're animals which can grow and resupply themselves very fast in a domesticated environment. And we see this today. Talk about the environment. We find there's another law in Jewish law, and that is the law of shooing away the mother bird in order to eat the eggs. If you come along a nest and you feel like a bit of omelette, you have a kosher bird sitting on the nest, you feel like an omelette, you have to shoo away the mother bird and take the eggs. You're not allowed to take them both. You're not allowed to take the bird and its eggs at the same time. Why not? So Ramban Nachmanides says, because we want to make sure the species survive. Take the bird and the animal and the birds and the eggs, maybe the species will die. You're killing the whole species. You're going to ruin everything. We see this today with all the wild species, all the hunting which has been going on. It's really decimated these wild species. Which species will survive? Only the domesticated animals will survive. Why? Because man has uses for them. So Torah says, eat only domesticated animals, because those are the ones which are going to survive. The other ones, if you're going to eat them, they're not going to survive. If you're going to hunt them, they're going to depopulate. They're going to go. So we find that kashrut has ethical reasons. Don't eat the blood. Blood is important. Don't take a limb from a living animal. It's cruelty to animals. We find there's many different laws of cruelty to animals which are prohibited. For instance, it's called in Hebrew, tzar balei chaim, causing cruelty to animals. The Torah tells us, twice does the Torah talk about the laws of Shabbat. When it talks about laws of Shabbat, it says, you will rest, you, your servant, your maidservant, and your animals will rest. Now, this is an interesting concept. You can't ride a horse on Shabbat. The horse cannot carry you on Shabbat outside an Eruv. It's carrying. The horse cannot carry. Think of it. A horse cannot carry on Shabbat outside an Eruv. The horse cannot plow for you. Say it's an automatic horse. It just goes and takes the plow and plows. It's not allowed to. You've got to stop your horse from plowing. There's an interesting Talmud. The Talmud says, one of the great rabbis at the time was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Elazar ben Azariah, we mentioned in the Haggadah, he says he is like a man of 70 years old. I'm sure you remember in the Haggadah and Pesach. Why? Because his beard apparently turned white overnight. He was 18 and he became like a man of 70. That's a different story. The Talmud says, he broke Shabbat. So Thomas says, how could he? He's a chief rabbi. How could he break Shabbat? He says, you know what? His animal broke Shabbat. His animal wore a bell on the street. He's carrying the bell around the street. So Thomas says, how could he? How could he? He's a chief rabbi. How could his animal even break Shabbat? He says, no, it wasn't his animal. It was his neighbor's animal, and he didn't tell her off. But it just shows that even an animal, the animal broke Shabbat, and it's attributed to its master. A person who has a dog, you better be careful when you take your dog for a walk on Shabbat. You can't even walk with a leash, because you're carrying the leash. If there's no Eruv, you're carrying the leash, so it's forbidden. The dog can't wear a harness. The dog is carrying the harness. If it's not a garment, it's carrying the harness. So it's interesting. The laws of Shabbat apply to animals. Why? Cruelty to animals. Keep the animal, let the animal have a day off as well. Who says only man gets a day off? Can the animals also get a day off? We find also, the Torah tells us, you should not plow with an ox and a mule together. Why not? The answer the Talmud gives is because it's too much strain for the plow, for the mule to keep up with the ox. The ox is very strong. The mule is very weak. To pull the plow, you need equal effort. Here the ox is pulling, and the mule is not. It's going to be an extra burden maybe on the ox, or the mule will have to work harder, and therefore it's going to be an extra burden on the mule. There should be two equal animals. Interesting. While treading on corn or on wheat, in those days, to grind the wheat, to separate the husks from the wheat, they'd make the ox walk all over the wheat. I don't know how hygienic that is. But they did in those days. It's like they used to have the wine presses with, till today, the expensive wine. You want to buy expensive Italian wine. But in those days, the ox would shell the wheat. All the chaff, get the chaff off by walking all over it. Torah says, when the ox does that, do not muzzle the ox. The ox has a temptation to eat. He's in the middle of something. He sees all this food. He's hungry. You're not allowed to muzzle the ox. Have mercy on the ox. The ox desires to eat. Let the ox eat. There's another law in the Torah, which we say in the Shema every day. I'm sure you don't pay attention. It's very hard to have a pet in Jewish law. If you have a pet, really, your pet is the boss. How is your pet the boss? The Torah says, "V'natati eser b'sadecha levimtecha v'yachalta b'zavata." I will give you grass in your fields for your cattle, and then it says you will eat and be satisfied. What does the Torah say first? Give grass in the fields for the cattle. First I'll feed the cattle, and then you guys eat. What does that mean? So the rabbis let out from there. If you have a pet and you want to eat dinner, you're not allowed to eat dinner before giving the pet to eat. So you've got a cat, a dog, and they're running around, and you're serving dinner. You didn't feed them yet. They're hungry. They look at the food. They're getting very hungry. Tsar Bala Chaim, causing cruelty to animals. So it's interesting how far this idea goes. The ethical laws, we see laws of kashrut really mirror this idea. Strict limits on the number of animals which we're allowed to kill. How are we allowed to kill them? Who's allowed to kill them? The requirement of killing kosher animals must be as painless and humane as possible. There's a law in Jewish law. It's interesting. Open up the code of Jewish law. One animal is not allowed to witness the slaughter of another animal. What the Germans didn't do to human beings, we're not allowed to do to animals. We can't kill two animals in the same room even. Why? Because the animal feels pain and suffering seeing the sight of another animal dying. It's got to be done in a different cubicle. The legislation ensures also that animal be killed as quickly and painlessly as possible with one cut. It's got to be as soon as possible. And we talked about the shochet, the ethics of the shochet. It's got to be a very ethical person. The knife has got to be sharp, not blunt. There can't be any pressure. It's got to be like cutting butter. It's amazing. I've done it myself. It's very hard for me to do. I learned shechita, but had nightmares afterwards. Don't want to do it again. But cows die the quickest, and they die the most painless death I've ever seen. Never seen before. Because a cow doesn't know what's going on. Sheep are very, very sensitive. They know what's going on. Cows don't know what's going on. Their head is somewhere else. Their neck is right over here. They can't see the knife. It's all gone. Sheep, it's a different story. They cry like babies. Nightmares. It's very terrible. So if you want to eat mutton, think about it. But we find there's other laws regarding this as well. Meat and milk are allowed to be cooked together. Bible tells us three times. We're going to talk about that in the laws of kashrut. We get to the laws. But obviously there's an ethical idea behind it. Why separate meat and milk? What's the connection between meat and milk? And the answer is Judaism is obsessed with separating life and death. We have to separate two things, life and death. Why? Because we are preoccupied with life and not death. Judaism is not interested in death. We're interested in life. Life is what is important. The Torah tells us, V'chai b'hem, you will live by these laws, not die by these laws. It's a mitzvah, an obligation. It's a mitzvah for a Jew to stay alive as long as possible. Life is very, very precious. We have to protect life. He's talking about today, euthanasia and other things today. It's against Jewish law. We talked about it. We talked about medical ethics. It's an ethical idea that life is totally important. In ancient Egypt, out of which Judaism arose, the culture revolved around death, not life. The pharaohs had this death culture. Everything revolved around death. So recently they just pulled out another, do you see that? National Geographic had a big article on pictures of they pulled out another mummy. Another mummy came out. See the obsession they had with death. Total obsession. They're priests. The priests of the Egyptians were priests of the dead. That's all they did. Their job was to protect the burial sites of all these people. Why? Because death was important. Death was, you're going to the next world, you're going to take everything with you. They took their gold, their silver, their animals, their pets, everything was mummified and taken with them. They thought they could take it with them. Judaism says no. Our culture revolves around life. We separate living, the milk, from death, which is meat. Separate it completely. Why? Because one represents life, one represents death, and we try and keep away from death. Kashrut also serves a crucial purpose of strengthening a Jew's self-control. Because really the idea is, today unfortunately there are millions of people in jail. I think there are 2 million Americans in jail. Right, Rose? There are about 2 million people in jail and growing rapidly. We're running out of jail space. That's why the taxes are maybe going up, because we have to pay for all these people in jail. We're running out of jail space. Why? Why are there so many people in jail? And the answer is they can't control themselves. They have desires and passions that they cannot control. Judaism says, we're going to nip this in the bud. As soon as the kid is born, of Italian wine. But in those days, the ox would actually shell the wheat, or the chaff, get the chaff off by walking all over it. The Torah says, when the ox does that, do not muzzle the ox. The ox has a temptation to eat. He's in the middle of something. He sees all this food. He's hungry. You're not allowed to muzzle the ox. Have mercy on the ox. The ox desires to eat. Let the ox eat. There's another law in the Torah, which we say in the Shema every day. I'm sure you don't pay attention. It's very hard to have a pet in Jewish law. If you have a pet, really, your pet is the boss. How is your pet the boss? The Torah says, "V'natati esa b'sadecha levimtecha v'yachalta b'zavata." I'll give you grass in your fields for your cattle, and then it says you will eat and be satisfied. What does the Torah say first? Give grass in the fields for the cattle. First I'll feed the cattle, and then you guys eat. What does that mean? So the rabbis learned out from there. If you have a pet and you want to eat dinner, you're not allowed to eat dinner before giving the pet to eat. So you've got a cat, a dog, and they're running around and you're serving dinner. You didn't feed them yet. They're hungry. They look at the food. They're getting very hungry. Tzar Bala Chaim, causing cruelty to animals. So it's interesting how far this idea goes. The ethical laws, we see laws of kashrut really mirror this idea. Strict limits on the number of animals which we're allowed to kill. How are we allowed to kill them? Who's allowed to kill them? The requirement of killing kosher animals must be as painless and humane as possible. There's a law in Jewish law. It's interesting. Go open up the code of Jewish law. One animal is not allowed to witness the slaughter of another animal. What the Germans didn't do to human beings, we're not allowed to do to animals. We can't kill two animals in the same room even. Why? Because the animal feels pain and suffering seeing the sight of another animal dying. It's got to be done in a different cubicle. The legislation ensures also that animal be killed as quickly and painlessly as possible with one cut. It's got to be as soon as possible. And we talked about the shochet, the ethics of the shochet. It's got to be a very ethical person. The knife has got to be sharp, not blunt. There can't be any pressure. It's got to be like cutting butter. It's amazing. I've seen... I've done it myself. It's very hard for me to do. And I learned Shechita, but had nightmares afterwards. Don't want to do it again. But cows die the quickest, and they die the most painless death I've ever seen. Never seen before. Because a cow doesn't know what's going on. Sheep are very, very sensitive. They know what's going on. Cows don't know what's going on. Their head is somewhere else. Their neck is right over here. They can't see the knife. It's all gone. Sheep, it's a different story. They cry like babies, nightmares. It's very terrible. So if you want to eat mutton, think about it. But we find there's other laws regarding this as well. Meat and milk are allowed to be cooked together. The Bible tells us three times. We're going to talk about that in the laws of kashrut. We get to the laws. But obviously there's an ethical idea behind it. Why separate meat and milk? What's the connection between meat and milk? And the answer is, Judaism is obsessed with separating life and death. We have to separate two things, life and death. Why? Because we are preoccupied with life and not death. Judaism is not interested in death. We're interested in life. Life is what is important. The Torah tells us, V'chai b'hem, you will live by these laws, not die by these laws. It's a mitzvah, an obligation. It's a mitzvah of a Jew to stay alive as long as possible. Life is very, very precious. We have to protect life. He's talking about today euthanasia and other things today. It's against Jewish law. We talked about it. We talked about medical ethics. It's an ethical idea that life is totally important. In ancient Egypt, out of which Judaism arose, the culture revolved around death, not life. The pharaohs had this death culture. Everything revolved around death. So recently, they just pulled out another... Do you see that? National Geographic had a big article on pictures of, they pulled out another mummy. Another mummy came out. See the obsession they had with death. Total obsession. They're priests. The priests of the Egyptians were priests of the dead. That's all they did. Their job was to protect the burial sites of all these people. Why? Because death was important. Death was, you're going to the next world, you're going to take everything with you. They took their gold, their silver, their animals, their pets, everything was mummified and taken with them. They thought they could take it with them. Judaism says no. Our culture revolves around life. We separate living, the milk, from death, which is meat. Separate it completely. Why? Because one represents life, one represents death, and we keep it, try and keep away from death. Kashrut also serves the crucial purpose of strengthening a Jew's self-control. Because really the idea is, today unfortunately there are millions of people in jail. I think there are 2 million Americans in jail. Right, Rose? There are about 2 million people in jail and growing rapidly. We're running out of jail space. That's why the taxes are maybe going up, because we have to pay for all these people in jail. We're running out of jail space. Why? Why are there so many people in jail? And the answer is they can't control themselves. They have desires and passions that they cannot control. Judaism says, we're going to nip this in the bud. As soon as the kid is born, we're going to control his desires and passions. How? We're going to teach a child self-control from very early ages. A child grows up, he's 2 years old, 3 years old. Mommy, I want to eat. Okay, say the blessing. But it takes me 2 minutes extra. But I'm hungry now. Say the blessing first. Control yourself, control your desires. You want to eat, you're hungry. You say, first wash hands, make sure your hands are clean. Say the blessing. It's self-control. It's tremendous self-control. You can't just have whatever you want. You can't just eat whatever you want. Mommy, I feel like a burger. We're right next to Burger King. You can't. It's not kosher. It's not kosher. But I want it. I'm hungry. Wait. Learn control. We'll get closer to Mystique Gourmet or whatever it is now. You'll have a kosher burger. But it really serves the purpose. The Midrash emphasizes this idea that this is really the basic idea behind all the commandments. All these rituals, what are they for? These rituals are basically to learn self-control. Anyone who has woken up for the minyan in the mornings will tell you the idea basically is to learn how to wake up early. Not many people can do it. It's very hard. Especially day in, day out. It's very hard to do. It's self-control. To pull yourself out of bed. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. Had a late night. You see the guys who are regulars. Self-control. Total mastery. Mastery of sleep. Mastery of sleep. The Bible really tries to limit the major urges of man. What are the major urges of man? Eating, sleeping, all their desires, sex. What are the major laws? You look at the major laws in the Shulchan Aruch, that's what they're concerning. The major they're concerning is, you want to eat, you got kosher, you got blessings, you got this, you got that. You can't. Why? Self-control and eating. If desires control them. You want to have sex? Okay. There's a whole list of books. There's a whole book, a volume, a quarter of the Shulchan Aruch is about, so that's all about marital laws. A quarter of the Code of Jewish Law is all about Evan Ezer's. One old book, one old volume. Come inside, I'll show you the volume. It's a big volume. You want to do it? Sure, go ahead. You have to get married. You have to go to mikveh. You have to do this. You have to do that. Okay. By that time, it's already controlled. I want it. I desire it. Come on. What can I do? That's really one of the hardest laws. So those are laws. These are the laws. I want to sleep. How do you sleep? You know the laws how to sleep? But I'm sleeping. Well, you shouldn't sleep on your back. You shouldn't sleep on your front. But what do you mean I'm sleeping? How can I control it? Yes, you can. You can even control how you sleep. Subconsciously. You can even control how a person sleeps. Self-control. A person can learn self-control. So what is the reasons for kashrut? We can answer every time a person sits down to eat a kosher meal. What should they be reminded of? They shouldn't just look at it and say, oh, it's great, look, it's good, eat. They should remind themselves, number one, is the animal is a creature of God. Don't take the death of an animal lightly. Hunting for sport is forbidden. We shouldn't treat any living creature irresponsibly. We're responsible for what happens to other beings. So those are the things which we have to worry about. Why am I eating? Am I eating, which we're going to talk about next week? Am I eating in order to live or living in order to eat? We have to really think about it. What are we doing over here? Some people just live because they want to eat. You see people today. It's one of the biggest problems in America is overweight. Why? People live to eat. Their main reason of living is to eat. You can see that. If they ate to live, then they would eat a healthy diet. But if the reason is to eat, is to live is to eat, then they don't care. My reason to live is to eat. If I can't eat, I can't live. What's more important? So kashrut brings us into face with these very, very important questions, the ethics of kashrut. But there are other reasons as well. So we'll go through some more reasons in terms of the ethics of kashrut. So we said, basically, there are four different levels. There are three different levels in terms of the questions we can ask about any mitzvah. There's the issue of the ethics, there's the issue of the mystical, and then there's the issue of the symbolic. What are the reasons of kashrut? So we try to give some ethical reasons in terms of what makes things kosher, the ethics of kashrut, to make people better people by controlling their diet, by being able to control themselves, their desires, to make people better by limiting the animal content in their diet. Maybe it's healthier. Torah knew that a long time ago. Maybe it's healthier. God does not want us to be meat eaters in the first place. The ideal would be vegetarianism. All these are ethical reasons for kashrut. Let's try and give some other reasons, symbolic reasons. We find that when the Torah talks about kashrut, it tells us that this law is really to be holy. Because you are holy people. What is kashrut going to do with holiness? So maybe the idea of holiness is, what is holiness? Holiness is really associated with self-control. Holiness, the idea of holiness is that a person is holy when they can control themselves totally. Totally in control of what they can do. So that's one of the ideas of kashrut which we said. The other idea is, a non-kosher animal is called a tameh animal. Now that's a different idea. That's not self-control. You got a kosher animal, which is called a tahor animal, which is a pure animal. And then you have the impure animals. If it's just an idea of self-control, why did they call the animals impure? Not the animal which is impure. It's the person who eats them which becomes impure. But he calls these animals impure. So obviously there's a deeper lesson over here. There's a deeper idea over here. And that is the idea of purity and impurity. And it's interesting, but I don't think there's been any research. I spoke to a nutritionist last week. And it just tells you, it's amazing how little research is done in the field of nutrition. How little the scientists today know about how good food is for us, which different kinds of food, how good they are for each person. There's so little research done. And every year they come out with something new. This cholesterol was bad a year ago. Now this cholesterol is also good. This cholesterol did something bad to you last year. Now today, all of a sudden, they find there's something else it does, which is good. Why? There's not enough research being done in this field. Judaism goes one step further. It says the diet does not only affect a person's body, diet also affects a person's soul. Some animals are impure, and some animals are not impure. Some animals are pure. What is that talking about? And here, I would like to see a bit of research being done in terms of take two people, similar natures, and feed them a totally different diet and see if they turn into different people in terms of their natures. How does a diet affect a person's nature? The Torah is telling us, it does. You have animals which are impure. If you eat them, you become defiled. It's a defiling process. You eat animals which are pure, it's a purification. And you can answer this in terms of rational thought. The wild animals, the propensities of the wild animals goes into the person who eats them. If you eat a lion, who knows what the person might turn into? You eat a carnivore, you might become a carnivore. You eat a domesticated animal, which doesn't have any carnivorous desires, maybe the person will be more placid. Okay, that's a simplistic idea, but there's obviously a deeper rationale over here, which the Bible is talking about in terms of tumah, in terms of defilement. Don't eat these forbidden animals. They're called tameh. They're called defiled. But the worst category of animals, what is the worst category of animals? What is the worst thing you can eat? That's a misconception. You know, it's interesting. You're right. This is one of the biggest misconceptions in amongst the Jews today. The worst thing you can eat is a pig. Let's put that to rest right now, because it's very important. What are the two signs for a non-kosher animal? Cloven hooves. It doesn't have cloven hooves and it doesn't chew the cud. The pig has one sign. What does the pig have? It has cloven hooves. So is it better than the others or worse? Logically, it should be better than the others. Why has at least one sign? A lion doesn't even have one sign. So what's worse, a pig or a lion? Lion, obviously. In fact, the Bible goes out of its way to list animals which only have one sign. And it's interesting, till today, they haven't found any other animals to add to that list. It's one of the proofs that the Bible was written by God, because no one else at that time could have known that these are the only animals. What are the animals which only have one sign? The pig has cloven hoofs, doesn't chew the cud. It's, what else? Huh? Okay, what else? What else has one sign or the other? A camel chews its cud, doesn't have cloven hooves. A hare and the rabbit. That's what the Torah tells us. Four kinds of animals. The pig is the only one with cloven hooves and doesn't chew the cud. Everything else chews. They all chew. They don't have cloven hooves. So it's interesting that four species mentioned explicitly by the Torah, and no other species till today have one of these species, one of these signs, not the other. But so we see the pig is not so bad. At least it has one of the signs. It's more kosher than the others who don't have any signs at all. In fact, the Talmud goes one step further. The Talmud says, the word for pig in Hebrew is what? Chazir. The word chazir, the Talmud says, comes, the source of the word is chozer. Chozer means to come back. It says, eventually, at the end of time, the pig will become kosher. Don't ask me how, don't ask me why, but they did. They thought, 5 years ago, I think I saw the article in the Jerusalem Post, they thought they found a kosher variety of pig. In the Far East, in Borneo or somewhere, there was a pig. It looked like a pig, but it ate and it chewed the cud and it had cloven hooves. And then the rabbis in Jerusalem said, no, spoil sports, you know. They said, no, still not kosher. So the pig is not that bad. What is the worst kind of non-kosher species you can eat? Bugs. Very good. What does the Torah say about bugs? It calls them shekets. Shekets, Hilahim. Even the word is a bit, it's a strange word, right? Shekets. What does shekets mean? It's disgusting. Really disgusting. A bug. People eat lobster and shrimp and those kind of things. They're shekets. So the words used in the Torah is tameh, defiled. That's for a pig or for a camel or for the other species, which are the animals which don't have these two signs. But for insects and bugs, shekets, ulahim. It's disgusting. It's abomination. It's terrible. So you find these two words which are used are also used in the Torah for two different things. They're used for immorality and they're used for idol worship. The same words which are used for these non-kosher species of animals are used for moral and religious offenses, namely idol worship and immorality. The Torah assures us that the mere consumption of forbidden food has the same contaminating effect on body, soul, and moral character of person as immorality and idolatry. It's interesting, the connection between the two. Okay, I don't know. Good question. But it's here that a philosophical difficulty seems to arise. And this difficulty has been one of the criticisms of dietary laws. How is it? How can food influence the spiritual life of man? How can we explain the transition of body to soul? How can you explain the transition of the physical properties of the food turn into something spiritual? How is it possible? So you find really that some of the greatest philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, would have discussed the relationship between the body and the soul. And we find that the philosophers, natural scientists, are in doubt as to what really constitutes matter, let alone mind. What constitutes the mind, what constitutes matter? And we find that, according to some of the philosophers, the body and the soul are closely related. In fact, today, it's a big thing today, the mind-body connection. There's a mind-body connection. Where is the soul? The soul is in the mind, according to Harambam. soul is in the mind. So it's there is a connection, seemingly, the Torah tells us, between what a person eats and what the effects on the soul are. There's something which today we still haven't done enough research. The effects of the diet, not just on the physiology of the human being, but also the spirituality of the human being. What are the effects of the diet on the spirituality of the human being? So until we start doing research, we have to go by what the Torah tells us. The Torah has been proven right in many different things. So a person will be more spiritually minded if they keep to this diet. A person who doesn't keep to the diet will be less spiritually minded. The Kabbalists try and give reasons why these certain animals have an injurious effect on a person's moral health. They give a whole analysis, the mental makeup of man, and they try to show how it's influenced by the food a person eats. The human body is the instrument of the soul and the only means by which the soul can discharge its tasks in this world. Let me give you an example. Today, there is no temple. There is no altar. There are no sacrifices. The Talmud says that today we do have an altar. What is the altar today? The table of the person. A person's table, the Talmud says, is an altar. What does that mean? What do we do on the altar? We sacrifice animals, we sacrifice flower offerings, we sacrifice wine offerings to God. We give things to God. How does a person at their table give things to God? And the answer is, the Kabbalists tell us, is the link between the spiritual and the physical in this world. What is the link between the physical and the spiritual in this world? There's only one link between the physical and spiritual in this world. You just said it, man. Human beings are the link between the physical and spiritual. Last week's Torah portion. That Adam was made from the ground, from afar, from the dust, and God breathed into him the soul, the living soul, the Shemat Chaim, which is the spiritual. So you have physical and spiritual. The Kabbalists view man as a factory of spirituality, taking the physical and transforming it to the spiritual. That's basically the idea of the Korbanot, the sacrifices. That's Ramban, Nachmanides. Nachmanides explains what the sacrifice is for, is to show us, to teach us this idea, that we can take something physical and transform it into a spiritual. You can take the physical entity of the meat and the wine and the water, and you can transform it into something spiritual. How do we do that today? And the answer is, today we do it by eating. We take the physical food, we eat it, and what do we do with the energy? That's the key. The key is, what do we do with the energy? So with the energy, we do something good. We've taken that food energy and we've transformed it into something spiritual now. A good deed is something spiritual, has a spiritual value. So we've taken the food, we've taken the physical, and we've transformed the physical into something spiritual. So that's really the symbolism of kashrut, a bit of the symbolism of the kashrut. There's other symbolisms and other forms of kashrut. For example, the Bible tells us one of the laws of kashrut is we're not allowed to eat the nerve in the leg, the sciatic nerve. Why? Because the Bible tells us that Jacob had a fight in the middle of the night with a strange being, and he got wounded in his thigh. And since that day, the Bible tells us the Jews have not eaten that nerve. It's like today, if you try and go and find a T-bone steak, kosher T-bone steak, you won't find it. And the reason for that is, in America, we don't know how to take out that nerve. People don't want to do it. Ashkenazi custom is, we don't take out the nerve, we just only eat. We don't eat the hindquarters at all because we don't have to take out the nerve. We sell it to the non-Jews and that's it. Jews only eat the forefront of the animal in America. In Israel, the Sephardim over there know how to do it, and therefore you can find a kosher T-bone steak. If you go to Israel, you'll find filet mignon. Over here, you won't find it. You won't find kosher filet mignon. I think there's only one store. I think it's Levana in Manhattan, which may have this kind of La Marais or Levana, two things, which have these sort of meats over there. The same part of the animal, same kosher animal. There are parts of the animal we're not allowed to eat. The fats, certain fats which are not allowed to be eaten. In fact, the penalties in eating them are karet, which is the soul is cut off. So even though the animal's kosher, again, discipline. You have a kosher animal. I went through all the process. Some parts I cannot eat even in the kosher animal. The nerve. We don't eat the whole hindquarters today in America because of one nerve. The nerve goes right through the... It's quite complicated to get it out. It's a very thin thing, and it goes right through the leg from the rump back downwards. What is the reason for that? Again, there's a symbolism over there. Is the being hurt Jacob on his leg. And therefore, we don't eat the leg of the animal. It's a very strange symbolism. What is the symbolism over there? We find that Jacob was going back to meet his brother Esav. He had a fight with Esav. He left. He was scared of Esav. Esav was coming towards him with 400 men. It says, Jacob was trembling. God promised Jacob, don't worry, Jacob. I'm going to be with you. You have nothing to fear. But it was the night before his next meeting with Esav. He was trembling. He had a fight that night. Maimonides says, symbolism. Who did he fight with? He fought with his fears. And it left him in paralysis. Maybe we can associate with this. God is telling you, go ahead, fight the war. You're going to be fine. You're going to be all right. Everything's going to be all right. But you know, it scares me. A person's scared, and they're fighting with their faith in God. That leads to a kind of paralysis. That's the messaging that he got hurt in his leg. The foundations of his faith were hurt. So we symbolize this by not eating that nerve. The nerve symbolizes the weakness in Jacob. The symbolism of the foundation of his faith. The leg symbolizes the foundations of the body. So it symbolizes the foundations of his faith was hurt. Doesn't say. It says he got hurt in his thigh. Which thigh, then doesn't say. And then it says the sun rose and he got healed. It was a temporary thing. It was the doubts of the night. When does a person have their doubts? When does a person lose their confidence? At night. He had his the doubts at night. When the sun rose, he was fine again. Believed, yes. The sun rose, I believe in God. When it's dark and it's night, in those days especially, it was a particularly fearsome experience. Especially getting to meet this wild man, Esav. It's a fearsome experience. When the sun rose, he got healed. His faith came back into him. Pardon? Yeah, his leg's healed. So the Bible tells us his leg was healed when the sun rose.